If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
We all know the name Greg Louganis, and when you hear that, you think greatest diver of all time. But what many don't know is that he got that title despite a difficult childhood where he was bullied and misunderstood to the point he felt such unhappiness that he thought his only way out might be to end his own life. Diving became his purpose, but as many athletes know, the aftermath of retiring from a sport can bring a multitude of highs and lows. What happens to these athletes during their aftercare? They've dedicated their lives to the sport, then what? Here to discuss his story and how he found purpose in life is the one and only Greg Louganis. And now, enjoy the show. So Greg, so happy that you're here. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
So my first question is, what is it like to be Greg Louganis?
What is it like to be Greg Louganis? Well, I don't know any different. So, you know, it is what it is. It's interesting that people actually remember who the heck I am, you know, and everybody seems to remember me hitting my head on the diving board in 88. Mm-hmm. So, and that's an image, but it's interesting because like young kids, little kids, they know me from Sharknado.
Wow.
I was in Sharknado 5. And then a little bit older, like in 20s, they know me from Entourage. I married Lloyd. And it's really strange how people make associations of who I am.
Right.
So,
You've done so many things to so many different people or generations, you mm-hmm. might be seen for different things or known for different things. So let's go back to your childhood for a second. Where were you born? I know that you were adopted. Tell us all about that.
I was conceived in Midway, mm-hmm. born in San Diego. My mother was 16 when she had me. And so she put me up for adoption. And fortunately, Francis and Peter Louganis, they were looking for children that the father who raised me was Greek, so he had dark hair, dark eyes. And so my mother wanted her children to reflect, you know, my dad. Mm. So fortunately, they found me. And So I spent my first 9 months in foster care, and then I was adopted, and my sister is 2 years older than me, and so she was in dance class because my mother didn't want a klutzy little kid knocking down lamps and all that. And so I was sitting in the waiting room, and when I was a year and a half, and I couldn't stay in the lines of the coloring books that they gave me. And so that was kind of boring. So I used to sneak, you know, crawl under the chairs and sneak into the studio and imitate what the, you know, kids were doing in the studio. And when I was a year and a half, the teacher said, oh, let him stay. Let's see what, we can teach him, what he can learn. So I started doing dance and acrobatics when I was a year and a half. Mm-hmm. First performance on stage was when I was three. And then when I was three, I got a partner, and we started doing recitals and performing at convalescent homes, because we couldn't compete in talent contests until I turned six. So then we were doing all of these performances, you know, performing in parades, festivals, all of that stuff. So once we started competing, Eleanor Smith and Greg Louganis, we were winning everything. You know, we won all kinds of stuff. She went into gymnastics and I followed her into gymnastics. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 8 years old, we had a pool built in our backyard with a diving board. And I was trying some of my gymnastics stunts off the diving board at home. And my mother didn't want me to kill myself, so she got me lessons.
Oh my God.
And first day out to lessons, the coach said, you know, will you join the club team? And I said, well, I'll think about it, because I was doing dance, jazz and tap, acrobatics, gymnastics, and now I'm adding diving. Mm-hmm. And so from age 8 to 12, I was doing all of these different things. And then when I was 12, I had Osney Slaughters, which is very common for young, active, super physically active children. So I had water on the knee. And so my doctor said, well, you should quit the dance, acrobatics, and gymnastics, but you can continue diving because you don't have the same type of impact. So then that's where all of that focus was narrowed to one discipline. And I was world champion for my age group at 13. Mm-hmm. And then 3 years after that, I was on my first Olympic team.
Do you think you were so good at that because you had so much background in the gymnastics and all the movement from when you were little?
Yeah. I mean, it's like Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about, the development. You know, champions aren't born, you know, they're created. I mean, and so all of those disciplines, the dance, you know, the rhythm and the timing of dance, and then acrobatics and gymnastics, the aerial type awareness and skill set just transferred into diving really well.
And did you like diving?
It was okay. My first love was gymnastics. I mean, it was my dream to make the Olympic team in gymnastics. But then when I had to quit, then I never thought I was good enough in diving.
Why not?
I just perceived everybody better than me. You know, everybody was better than I was.
Right.
And so, I kind of tried to do the best that I could. Mm-hmm. And my first Olympics, it was really challenging, because at that time, Dr. Sammy Lee coached me for a very short window of time. Mm-hmm. He was the Olympic gold medalist in men's 10-meter platform in 48 and 52. And he coached Bobby Webster to win two golds in 60, 64. And I was in 76, I was going up against Klaus DiBiase, who's going for his third Olympic gold medal to break his record. So my sole purpose on this planet at that time was to prevent Klaus from winning that gold medal.
Wow.
And I failed.
And you were 16 years old, right?
Yeah.
So, and you got the silver.
and I got the silver.
Oh, how devastating.
Well, you know what? The highest rate of suicide amongst Olympians is Olympic silver medalists.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they're there to get the gold, and it's so devastating when they don't.
You're so close. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get the gold, that's kind of expected. But if you're a silver medal, you just not quite there. And if you're a bronze medalist, chances are through the competition, you're just grateful to have something to bring home.
Wow.
So, yeah. So there's a, and also at 16, it was very confusing for me because I couldn't understand why all of these people were celebrating me when I was feeling like a failure.
Right. So I want to get into that. So going back a little bit into your childhood, you talk about not being happy and having a really difficult time. What was going on?
You know, I went to, I can't remember how old I was. I was probably around 12. And I went to my mom and I said, because I didn't, at that age, I didn't view suicide the way that other people described it. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that, you know, I said, Mom, I can understand how somebody can die of sadness. Hmm. And that's how I put it to her. So, you know, yeah, I had chronic depression, you know, growing up.
And you were getting bullied, right, from people?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of things did they say to you?
Well, I was going to a school that was predominantly white Caucasian, and I had darker skin. And so, yeah, I was called a lot of names. And also, I'm sure I was a little soft, effeminate. And so I was called faggot and also I'm dyslexic. So I didn't know about dyslexia until I was, you know, a freshman in college. I was given dyslexia as a vocabulary word and I read it and I'm like, oh my God, that's me. There was a recognition. It's like, oh my God, I'm dyslexic. You know, I'm not all those things that the kids used to say about me. Right. Because when I started school, I stuttered and I was having a difficult time reading. So I was in speech therapy and remedial reading. Mm-hmm. So I was set apart from the other kids.
What was your relationship with your father like?
Ooh, that was challenging. Growing up, it was challenging. And I'm so grateful that we were able to come full circle because I took care of him the last 6 weeks of his life.
Wow.
He died of cancer. And that that time, I mean, that year was just so healing. Mm-hmm. Because he was diagnosed with cancer in, I think, 90. And so when he was diagnosed with cancer, I came out to him about my HIV status. And so then it was kind of a crusade for life and quality of life. And we had some really important conversations about what that meant to us. Mm. You know, that we want the quality of life, not the, necessarily the quality, the quantity. Mm. So yeah, it was a very healing time.
So you got to make some peace with him.
Yeah. Yeah. That I'm really, really grateful for.
Well, and also when you started to perform and win, I assume he was very proud and was there. What was he not?
Yeah. I mean, he got, once I started into diving, mm-hmm. Growing up, my assumption was that he didn't take any interest in the dance and acrobatics and gymnastics because it was, you know, growing up where I was, that was a sissy sport. And so I thought that my father felt the same way. But when we talked, he said it was just where he was in life, that he was trying to provide for his family. So he had to spend more hours at his job and because he was trying to do the best that he could to provide. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really see that part. I just knew that he was not there.
Right.
But once I started into diving, I think he was on better financial footing. And so he was around a lot and he got a little too involved in my thing, where I did have to ask him when I was 11 years old, I asked him not to take me to, not to stay at practice. He could take me to practice, drop me off, but not to stay.
Why did he get involved and try to tell you how to do things or heckle you?
Yeah, it was, the drives home would be total repetition of everything that coach told me. And, you know, and it was pretty intense.
Right. That's understandable. I think a lot of kids go through that. Tell me about your relationship with your mother. I know you follow sort of a saying that she said, which is make everywhere you go better because you were there. Talk to me about that.
You know, my mother, she really was incredible. I mean, we had a rough start. I mean, I spent my 13th birthday in Juvenile Hall. I was kind of out of control.
Oh.
And so a part of my release out of Juvenile Hall was to go to school, go to practice, and be home and help my mother with chores. Mm-hmm. And so during that time, we really grew and bonded at that time. And I realized she was the one person that it didn't matter. You know, it's like, these are choices that you're making. Mm-hmm. You know, like when people say, oh my God, you made all these sacrifices and you gave up your childhood, you know, to be, you know, this Olympian and all of these pursuits. You know, those were choices I made, you know, and so my mother always made it very clear that it was my choice. Right. So I had to stand by my choices that I made.
Right, right. She sounds like an amazing woman. Okay, so let's go back to your first Olympics. You were a sophomore, you were 16. What was that like? Tell me about the pressure. How much training goes into actually getting there? Like, give me a day in the life.
Well, okay. So at that time, and my training changed throughout my career, because early on it was learning new dives, getting my degree of difficulty up. And so it was a lot of repetition.
And just, out of curiosity, when you're practicing for dives, do you do them all the time in the water, or do you start on land and kind of do it like a gymnastics move? Like, what does a diver do to practice?
Yeah. So you learn portions of the dive. Back when I was, you know, when I was learning my dives, we didn't have a lot of the technology that they have now. That came in the middle of my, towards the beginning of my career, where you had trampoline, spotting belt. You know, my coach could hold me up and we execute the dive on a trampoline before we take it onto the board. So we know what we're going to look, you know, what we're going to feel, what we're going to see. So that changed. And when I first started, it was like, okay, put a sweatshirt on or something, so if you smack, it doesn't hurt as much. Mm-hmm. So I went through that in learning a lot of my dives early on. But Ron O'Brien, he was my coach. Mm-hmm. Ron O'Brien, he coached me. I went to his camp first when I was 15, and he taught me how to spot. So he had me in the belts. Dr. Samuel Lee, he didn't know how to pull ropes, you know, to do the harness. He didn't know any of that stuff. But Ron O'Brien, he got me in the belts and put me on trampoline. I learned the dives. He taught me how to spot. And that's when my diving career really shot up, because after that camp, I qualified for the finals in the senior nationals, which qualified me for the Olympic trials in 1976.
Got it. Now, at this point, are you feeling better about yourself because you have a purpose and you see that you're so good at things? Did the kids that once made fun of you start to see that you are somewhat of a hero? Like, what was going on in your personal life there?
I compartmentalized my life. Hmm. What I did outside of school, I didn't let anybody know.
Interesting.
Because I had an experience where, I think it was in third grade, I did a modern dance routine with acrobatics to Tears of a Clown. And one of my bullies, you know, he picked a fight and was beating me up, you know, he's pushing my face into the asphalt. And I was thinking to myself, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to show you, I'm going to become the best in the world at something. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to show you. So it was kind of, yeah, I mean, I did have that motivation, you know, kind of initially. But that grows, you grow, you know. I was, you know, pretty dominant for a whole decade. Mm-hmm. You know, my first world championship title was in 78, and my last world-class competition was the Olympic Games in 88.
Right, right.
It was kind of a decade of dominance, and that is all due to, you know, my coach, Ron O'Brien. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were an incredible team.
Right. So in between there, you did go to college. You got an athletic scholarship, right? And then what did you major in?
Drama.
Drama.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm an actor. Yeah. So drama, minor in dance.
So you really followed that passion throughout your life, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because people think that I'm really super competitive because of all of the things that I've done. And I'm not competitive. It's for me, it's always about the performance. And that's what Ron O'Brien understood. And so we would play games. He would design these games. In order to break 700 on 10 meter platform, I had to average 8.5s or better on all 10 dives that I executed. Mm-hmm. So some of our training sessions were, we would play the 700 game. And so I would go through my list of dives and I'd be jumping back and forth over that 8.5 mark. And sometimes I was successful, sometimes I wasn't. Mm-hmm. But I did that in practice before I ever did it at the Olympic Games in 88. Mm-hmm. Or 84. 84 is when I broke 700 on a 10-meter platform.
Right. So in 1980, you didn't go to the Olympics because the U.S. boycotted the Olympics in Moscow, but you were expected to win a gold then. So then you went in 1984, you were probably at your peak of fitness, you had been training. How did it feel going into that Olympics?
You know, I knew, I had announced my retirement. I was planning on retiring after that Olympic Games. So, you know, I knew, you know, I had to wait eight years. The interesting thing is I didn't feel like I deserve to be competing on the world stage until after the 82 World Championships. This was 2 years after the Olympic Games in 1980. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was Guayaquil, Ecuador, and Alexander Portnoy was introduced as Olympic gold medalist, 1980. And I was introduced as Olympic silver medalist, 1976. And I remember at that competition when we were being introduced, smiling to myself and thinking, you got the gold because I wasn't there. And so I always wanted my performance to speak for itself. I didn't want to have to speak for my performance. And so I was just determined. And at that competition, I was the last diver, and it was the last dive. And I looked at the scoreboard to make sure that the dive number was correct. And I saw my score flashing. So that meant I didn't have to do my dive. I already won.
Oh, wow.
And it was, I think it's still the highest margin that any world championships ever been won. And
that must have felt incredible.
Yeah, it did. It did. Because it was making a statement without having to say it, to vocalize, to put into words.
Right.
I let performance speak for itself.
So the 1984 Olympics is where you secure your place in history. You won a gold in both the springboard and the platform. From that, you said you were planning on retiring, but obviously you didn't. So did you get some endorsements? Were you planning on being on a Wheaties box? Like, what was the goal there?
So I got my Olympic gold medals after the 84 Olympic Games, mm-hmm. went to the Nationals, the USA Diving Nationals. I broke Cynthia Potter's record for national titles. And I was ready to move on. But I was also one of the athlete representatives to push for trust funds to be put into place for athletes after college, they can do the endorsements, they can do the speaking engagements, exhibitions, and all that. And that money they can draw on for their training expenses. And so I went to the president of USA Diving at that time. And I said, Phil, what's going on with trust funds? He said, well, the only one that it affects is you. And so we don't have to spend the money on attorneys to get it put into place. And I said, fine, I'm not retiring. Do your homework. So my intent was to stay eligible long enough to get the trust funds put into place for the divers that I felt like that was going to be my legacy.
Right.
And so it took 2 years to get it done. And I found myself at the World Championships in Madrid and I won. And Ron O'Brien came to me and said, well, what are you going to do? You know, he said, it's just 2 more years to the next Olympics and you won the World Championships. I said, yeah, I can hang on for 2 more years.
And but had you gotten a big endorsement at that point?
No. I mean, there were so many, you know, rumors of my sexuality and all that. And, you know, a lot of people stayed away, from that. It was really a different time. Hmm. It really was a different time.
So was it known in the public that you were gay or just within your community of divers, swimmers, people doing that?
It was speculated. I mean, any of the articles that was one thing back then, a lot of the sports reporters, they respected that, I don't talk about my personal life. And so they respected that. But there was, plenty to read between the lines. I was out to friends and family and, people who were close to me, it wasn't an issue. Right. I did sign with the William Morris Agency right after the 84 Olympic Games. And some of the agents said, just tone down the gay thing. I'm like, okay. So, I felt I justified it that everybody's entitled to a personal life. And so that was kind of how I conducted myself.
So I wanted to ask you, obviously the stigma there, was what prevented then a lot of these endorsements. But at the time, I even remember as a kid watching you, and I was, in 1984, I was probably 9, but, I remember thinking you were the greatest. And at that age, you're not thinking about somebody's sexuality, so you affect people in different ways. So I want to ask you, did you get nervous when you were diving? Did you have any superstitions like that you would do or think before you would get up on the platform?
No, it was interesting because Ron O'Brien, he knew like if I was going to hit a dive or not, because everything was just, there's a rhythm, mm-hmm. And I had a very distinct rhythm. If I went too quickly or not soon enough, that can, it's a chances are, you'd probably miss the dive. But there's a rhythm. But also, as far as having any superstitions or anything like that, I learned early on that, stuff happens. You may have your lucky chamois and it may get sucked up in the gutter, So you just, not to hang on too preciously to those, those little quirks or habits or, superstitions.
Right. I think a lot of us have seen you, seen the videos of you preparing and standing right before you dive. Are you thinking anything or are you clearing your mind? What are you doing in those seconds before you dive?
Well, okay. So if you think about it, a dive takes less than 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. So you have less than 3 seconds. And in that 3 seconds is your creation. And in that creation is total chaos. Because there's no mirrors, there's no wires, there's nothing. It's a free fall. And so every creation is different. You can't reproduce something that's already passed. Mm-hmm. It'll be different. So you have to be open to make all of those adjustments to be as successful as you can be at that moment in time.
So would you have to prepare and think what you were about to do, or it just came to your body naturally?
Well, it would depend, you know, like it depends on what the dive was. There may be, you know, one thing, you know, one point that, you know, I'm thinking about reverse 3.5, relaxing your shoulders. But oftentimes it's more of a pep talk, you know, that you're having with yourself. And one of the things when I was in a tight situation, you know, I would always remind myself, no matter what happens, my mother's still going to love me. Mm-hmm. And at the last dive of my competitive career in Seoul, Korea, my reverse 3.5, Shin Ni was leading going into that dive. I had to hit my last dive, and I had a higher degree of difficulty, so I didn't have to beat him in score. I just had to match him. And I remember thinking to myself, no matter what happens, my mother's still going to love me. And then this image came into my head that my mother sitting at home, watching it on TV, because they were home, they weren't at the Olympic Games. And then I do this bomb of a dive. The splash goes all the way up to the 10-meter platform when you're not supposed to make a splash. And then my mother bouncing up and down on the couch, clapping, saying, oh, wasn't that a pretty splash? You know, because that would be my mom.
Yeah.
And it just made me laugh.
Right.
So you learn different techniques to get yourself in that space away from your left brain, which is judgment, and maintain your right brain, which is performance.
Yeah. So now we're talking about the Olympics in 1988 in Seoul. Where was your mindset coming in to that Olympics?
You know, Ron O'Brien and I were really distracted going into that Olympic Games because, one, I was the odds-on favorite going in because I was world champion and previous Olympic champion. And also 6 months prior to that Olympic Games, I was diagnosed with HIV. And at that time in 88, we thought of HIV as a death sentence.
Right.
So it's like, if you get diagnosed with HIV in 88, then basically you have 2 years.
Right.
Get your affairs in order, you know, if that. So there were all of these things. I remember Ron O'Brien's son-in-law, they committed suicide, you know, when we were at the trials. And, you know, I mean, there were so many things happening in both of our lives. Mm-hmm. And so we were really distracted. I think when I hit my head on the springboard, that was, it was kind of like a wake-up call, you know, to pay attention, that nothing's guaranteed, anything can happen. And, you know, and he gave me a choice. He said, you know what, after I hit my head on the springboard, you know, I thought I was out of the competition, but then found out that I think I was in fifth place. So I would have made finals, but I did have to do my last two dives. Mm-hmm. So it really kind of got us to focus. He told me, he said, you don't have to go back out there. You know, you don't have to get back out there. You just hit your head on the board. That's very traumatic. You know, and I just turned to him, kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and said, I don't want to give up without a fight.
Right.
And so that's when Ryan White, who was a buddy of mine, he's the young boy in Indiana that contracted HIV through his clotting factor. He's a hemophiliac. Mm-hmm. And he fought for the right for other kids in the same position for education. Mm-hmm. And he was a fighter. And so he was my inspiration to kind of get back out there and fight for it.
Wow. So let's talk about that moment for a second. Were you, was it like any other dive? Have you done that dive? How many times have you done that dive before?
Oh God, I don't even know. I mean, probably definitely in the hundreds, right. Maybe in the thousands.
Right. And how difficult of a dive was it that you were about to do?
Well, you know what? Reverse 2.5 pike was a really solid dive for me. I mean, it was one of my best dives. And, you know, when I was going, doing my approach, taking off the board, I knew I was going to be close because I stood up a little straight. And so when I came out of the dive, I brought my hands in close to my body so that they wouldn't hit, because that's what you're usually worried about, is hitting your hand or your arm. And I thought I was well past the board. And then I heard this big hollow thud. And I go crashing in the water thinking, what the hell was that? And I go, oh my God, it was my head. Wow. And my first emotion, I was embarrassed because I was thinking, oh my God, I hit my head on the diving board in front of the world. And I was trying to think, you know, how can I get out of the pool without anybody seeing me? I mean, I was just so embarrassed.
It wasn't painful. It must have been shooting pain or a headache.
No, because you're in the midst of a competition. It's a high level competition, so you don't feel anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the adrenaline going and all that, you know, it's not. And also there were reports, blood in the pool and all that stuff, which is total crap, because when you get a cut like that, you know, especially in that environment, it takes a while before it starts bleeding.
But at the time, there was so much fear and ignorance around AIDS and HIV, and nobody knew you had it besides just your coach, right? Maybe a few other people that were close to you. But what was going through your head? Because at the time, did we know how you could contract it? Did we know how dangerous it was?
Yeah, I mean, really the only ones that were in, it's blood to blood contact. So the only ones that were really putting any, concern would be the doctors who were sewing my head up, you know, Dr. Ben Rubin and Dr. James Puffer.
Which he did do without using gloves. Did that worry you?
They didn't have gloves. Mm-hmm. You know, this is 88. This is not, you know, that was not, those considerations, you know, it was so far-fetched that anything like that might happen that they, you know, didn't have gloves.
Yeah, right. When you first heard that you had HIV, how did you feel?
Oh, well, I thought life was over, you know, because I went in for, I was having an ear issue. And so I went into the doctor and said, oh, by the way, you know, I'd like to do an HIV test anonymously. And so my cousin, who was my doctor in Florida, you know, he did it and said, oh, you don't have anything to worry about, blah, blah, blah. And so I did it. But then when it came back positive, then my thought was, because I was training in Florida, my home was in California. And so I thought, if I was to HIV positive, I'm not going to waste my coach's time and everybody else's time. I'm going to pack up my bags, go back to my home, lock myself in my house and wait to die. Because that's what we thought of HIV at that time. Mm-hmm. And so when Chris came over and told me that I was HIV positive, I just assumed I would be packing up and going home. And he encouraged me to stay. He said, the healthiest thing for you is to stay and train. We don't know how long you've been positive, and you've worked so hard to get to where you're at. And that's probably the healthiest thing I could do for myself. And it was easier to focus on the diving because it gave me something to look forward to. I didn't get obsessed with the diagnosis.
Right. Right. And I love that he gave you a purpose and a hope, sort of. So now take me back to the moment where you just gotten your stitches in and you're getting back on the board, because you said you were in fifth or something and you had to do your other dives to qualify. How was your confidence level? Were you nervous you were going to hit your head again?
Well, yeah. I mean, because I didn't know, you know, people said, how did you get over that? You don't have time to get over that. In order to get over something, you need to process and you go through that. I mean, you understand with trauma, you know, it takes time for that to unfold. I didn't have time. Mm. And so I just had to set that aside like it never happened.
Right.
And I remember, you know, I set the fulcrum, they made it, they announced the dive, which is going in the same direction, reverse 1.5 with 3.5 twists. And I could hear an audible gasp from the audience. And I took a deep breath and patted my chest because I felt like my heart was pounding outside my chest. And then the people in the vicinity who saw that laughed. And I started laughing because they were scared for me and I was scared for me. I didn't know what was going to happen. And so, you know, right before I went, I just thought, you know, this is the Olympic Games. You can't hold back.
Right.
So, and as it turned out, it was the highest scoring dive of that Olympic Games.
Right. And you ended up qualifying, you ended up getting the gold. Yeah. And yeah. then you got the gold on the 10 meter platform, like you were discussing earlier, against the Chinese opponent, correct? Was keeping that secret exhausting for you?
Oh my God. Yeah. So exhausting. You know, it was just terrifying. It was really hard, but you know, and also what was going on at that same time, I was also in an abusive relationship.
Right. And this is the person that you got it from?
No, not necessarily. No, I mean, a lot of people want to say that because, you know, it's easier for them, you know, but chances are we were probably both positive when we got together because my partner before, and this is before we knew about safe sex and all that stuff, he died of HIV.
And
complications with AIDS. So chances are he was positive, I was positive, and we just didn't know it.
Right, right. So after the Olympics in 88, you did retire finally from diving, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what happened? So what is it like for a professional athlete who has dedicated the majority of his life to the sport? How do you do your second act? How do you find purpose? How do you define who you are? I think that's really hard for a lot of professional athletes.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it really is a difficult transition. It is, because then you have to kind of embrace a new identity, you know, and embracing that new identity, who is that person?
Right. So what did you do for a paycheck after that?
I did a lot of speaking, engagements, personal appearances. That was mostly, you know, a bit of acting here and there. You know, I did Cinderella, Long Beach Civic Light Opera. I did a one-man show in New York. I was in Jeffrey for about 6 months in New York. I did a lot of different stuff. I mean, it's interesting because I really have climbed a lot of mountains and varied. I remember when I was at the University of Miami, I was doing Equus. And Jimmy Puig was our Dr. Dysart. And he came to me and said, Greg, I understand. I know Greg Louganis, the actor, but I understand you dive as well. I was like, well, yeah, I'm kind of on scholarship for that. But, you know, it's just, I always wanted to be accepted in whatever I was doing, whether it was dance or acting, you know, to be embraced on my own merit for whatever activity that was.
Right. So eventually you decide to write a book and you go on Barbara Walters and Oprah and you announce to the world that you are gay and you are HIV positive, correct?
Yeah.
So
yeah, at a time when you don't do that kind of shit.
Right? So what made you do it? You didn't have to do it, right? So why did you choose to do that?
I felt that it was the next step in my progression, in who I was, because I felt like I was, with all these secrets, I felt like I was living on an island with barely a phone for communication to the outside world. And so by letting go of those secrets, and I knew I was probably not alone. You know, I think that was, you know, that was key. You know, if I was suffering like I was, then I'm sure I'm not the only one. And
so how was that received by the public?
I had, my mother was really terrified for me. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of friends who were very, very concerned, but it was amazing when I was on book tour. I mean, thousands of people were showing up and saying, oh my God, you saved my life.
Right.
You helped me come out to my friends and family about whatever, you know, your sexual identity, HIV, leave an abusive relationship, you know, all of these kind of things that people connected with.
Right. And you became sort of the spokesman for what you had gone through and your, you know, trauma or, you know, the shame or the grief that basically everyone feels. And you were able to sort of get it out of you, and that gave hope to other people to do the same.
Yeah. I mean, it really was incredible. I mean, the book tour was so emotional. Eric Marcus, my co-author, you know, we would be in tears, you know, just and joyful tears.
Yeah, that's got to feel good, touching people like that.
Yeah.
And knowing that you made a difference for someone else, that your pain happened to be able to make someone feel connected and make a difference. So you then went on to do some advocacy, right, for HIV and LGBTQ. Talk to me about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's coming out is a process, you know. First person you have to come out to is yourself, you know, and you can be coming out about an illness. You can be coming out about who you're dating, or, you know, it's a process in accepting and embracing who you are.
And just like everyone else, you've definitely had some highs and lows. And you talk about it, you know, in your book. What was it like to live in the nothing, to live in the low for some of the time, as you talk about?
Yeah, I mean, some of the lows are pretty, I mean, I've had really high highs and really low lows. How do you get through the low lows? I always remind myself, you know, whatever's going on is temporary.
Yeah. This too shall pass.
This too, yeah, exactly. And the thing is, you also have to be willing to let go of the good stuff too. You know, it's just like, you can't hang on to, oh, I'm an Olympic champion, I'm a world record holder, I'm blah, blah, blah. You know, if you hold on to that too tightly, and then it goes, you know, then somebody breaks your record, you know, you aren't happy trying to hold on to something that you are no longer.
Right. That you were.
That you were. Right.
So what advice would you give to people that are sort of stuck in their first act? Because I know it's so hard to move to your second act, to find your purpose, to find what makes you happy after you've hit this, you know, major high, and you feel like that was, you know, that was who you were, and you'll be nothing else without that. Talk to people about what it's like to move on from that and reinvent yourself.
Well, it's funny, because oftentimes what happens is, you know, especially like if you're an Olympic champion, you do this, then people start defining you. They start saying, oh, you are this, so you have to be that. You know, and so they choose your path, you know, and as people pleasers, oftentimes we go for that ride for a while.
Right.
And so then when somebody asks, well, what do you want? What does Greg Louganis want? I mean, I had to take 2 weeks and meditate over that. It's like, what, you know, what is it that really drives me, that sparks that interest, that sparks that flame, you know, and what do you come up with? And the thing that came up for me was dogs and health and wellness, you know, because I had two concussions in my diving career. I've had issues with that, you know, trying to be go in a more natural approach to issues of mental health, and as well as physical health,
right?
You know, how I'm doing, you know, trying to maneuver through the world in a positive, healthy way.
Right. So you also picked up, you mentored in the diving community, which sounds amazing and right up your alley, obviously. And then you talk about training and showing dogs. You're still doing that, right? Is that one of the things you continue?
Well, so I was working with the athletes in preparation for London. And it was so funny because, like, when I first started working with them, the US has been pretty dominant in the sport of diving. And then after my retirement, then we got one medal in 2000, which was Laura Wilkinson. Mm-hmm. We got zero medals in 2004, and they added synchronized diving. So we had four more shots at medals and we got nothing.
Wow.
2008, we got nothing. And then when I started working with the kids, I said, okay, what's your ultimate diving goal? And they'd say, make the Olympic team. And then I'd say, and then what? And they'd look at each other. It's like, make the Olympic team. And I said, well, don't you want to get on the podium? Don't you want to win? You know, none of them had that in their training process. You have to train for that stuff.
Right.
It's not just going to happen. Yeah. So once I started working with them, changing their mindset, they got four medals in 2012, three medals in 2016.
Wow. So you made a difference. And you're still doing the dog stuff, right?
Yeah, still doing the dog stuff. And actually, I, you know, love the dog stuff because they're so pure. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to hold grudges. They're not going to, you know, second guess. Yeah. You know, they're just really, truly honest.
But you do training or you do agility. What exactly do you do with them? I see you on your Instagram. It looks great.
Well, I train. I mean, you know, I compete in dog agility.
Mm-hmm. With your own dog or with others?
Yeah. I have trained other dogs and run other people's dogs for them. Mm-hmm. But I have G, who's my Hungarian Pumi, who's got a lot of talent, and have hopes for world team for him. And then Pax. Pax is a Pyrenean Shepherd.
Oh, wow.
And she does agility too. It's just that she'll do it because daddy wants her to.
Right. So can any dog do it if they're trained? Like, can I train my Pomeranian or my rescue pit bull to be doing agility, or they have to be born with it?
No, you can train. Yeah. Because physically, you know, they may be limited, you know, to how fast they can go and what they're capable of doing. But given the right education, you know, almost any dog. I mean, I'm actually surprised at some of the dogs that I see videos of, you know, the Mastiff doing agility. There was a Great Dane in Arizona that used to do competitive agility, and actually really good
with those long legs. My God.
Yeah. I mean, he'd actually have to crawl through the tunnel to get through. It was just like, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. That must've been great to watch. Wow. So, and you're going to continue to do that.
Yeah.
Forward. That makes you happy. Obviously I can tell.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got it. I just did a workshop yesterday with an international judge/competitor. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. It was great because I was away from dog agility for about 10 years and now I'm coming back and so much has changed.
Right.
So there's a lot of new stuff I have to learn.
Right. It's always changing. So yeah. What is going on in your life now? What do people have to look forward to with you and seeing you?
Well, we're still working on that podcast. But also I'm taking it upon myself to, there was talk about a biopic and I'm digging in myself, you know, to start writing the script. So, it just struck me. I was just at the Olympian and Paralympian reunion a few weeks back, and I was just somehow reminded. It just came to me that, you know, if you don't write your own story, You're allowing other people to write it for you.
Right.
And it doesn't always reflect who you are. And I really want something to reflect who I am.
And who would you say you think you are?
Well, there's a lot of things that I've done that a lot of people are not aware of. Mm-hmm. Because other people have taken credit for it. And also just not being one to toot my own horn. Mm-hmm. Which is really weird because, like, we're in a society now where it's like, oh, you've got to stand up for yourself and speak up, you know, and tell everybody what, you know, and they're bragging about all the things they've done. The way that I was raised is let my performance speak for itself, do, and it will be returned to you.
Right.
So it's a very different mentality.
Yeah. And I love what you just said, because that's actually why I started this podcast and named it Misunderstood, is because there are people like you, like me, like so many, that their lives have sort of been narrated for them by the media, by the, you know, public that, you know, feeds on what the media says, and they just know about one thing. Most people probably just know that you're the greatest Olympic diver ever or the greatest diver in history, right? But they don't know all the parts to you, because there's so much more than that. And as a person, you know, you feel, and we feel like, you know, you want to share who you are, not just that one bit, because that was something you did once, but there's so much more to you that makes you just as great as that. So that's literally why I started this podcast and wanted you on specifically, because I think that's a huge, huge message for people and important for people to know.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, you know, just because somebody speaks, you know, they're a public speaker, or if they're actors, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are extroverts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's assumed that they're extroverts and they're looking to gain attention or whatever, attention seeking or whatever, you know, and that is not true for many of us.
Yeah. All right. I just have a few more questions before we go. What is the biggest misconception of HIV and AIDS today, do you think?
I'm not sure, you know, because I can't speak for everybody. I think that, you know, I think there's still some stigma surrounding it, but I don't know what that is. I don't understand it, because there's so much good information that's out there, you know, of how you get HIV, but also how you don't get HIV. Also, for those that recently seroconvert, that it can potentially be manageable. And so to be mindful, you know, if you're undetectable, then you're untransmittable.
Yeah. And I think that it's changed so much since, you know, when you were diagnosed, since I was little, the fear really has gone away. It's no longer seen as just, you know, a gay disease. Anyone can get it. But it's not seen as necessarily a death sentence at all. It's manageable. It can be, you know, you can live a long, healthy life and have no signs of it eventually. Correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been very helpful in the LGBTQ community, spreading awareness. I wanted to ask you your thoughts on politicians like DeSantis, what they've done in Florida, the don't say gay rule. Should children be able to learn about sexuality in school? If that happened when you were younger, would that have helped you feel better about what you were going through?
Oh, sure. I mean, that, you know, it's important that, you know, we give, you know, as much accurate information mm-hmm. out there. I mean, it's you're not going to catch it. and also I mean, I had a conversation with a neuroscientist leading researcher about sexual identity, gender identity, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. And he explained, you know, what his findings were. And it's like, yeah, you know, you, when they say that you're born gay, you are. And he has research to, you know, to prove that. And so having those understandings, knocking down, you know, when you have new thoughts, you know, your beliefs are a thought that you continue to think. If there's a flaw in those thoughts, then you have to change your beliefs. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to get people to change beliefs, which is really challenging to do, because people want to hold on to beliefs like they're, you know, like they're true. Mm-hmm. But you get more facts and understand that it's, you know, maybe those facts aren't correct.
Right, right. There's a bill being considered that would give doctors and insurance companies the right to deny care to the LGBTQ plus community. How do you feel about that?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's so silly, you know, that we are, you know, you need to look at a whole person. Being LGBTQAI, you know, whatever letter that is I am, it does not define who I am. There's a whole human being behind each individual. And each individual, I mean, all we want to do is be, you know, loved, you know, and everybody is, you know, that is a human right.
Right. Regarding sports, there have been protests around races featuring trans women. Should biological men that become women be able to compete in sports, in your opinion?
In my opinion, I have a different perspective because of an incident that happened after the 88. I was diagnosed with HIV. They put me on AZT right away because they wanted to treat me very aggressively. One of the side effects from AZT or HIV, low testosterone. And early on in my training, you know, hitting the gym, breaking everything down before it builds up, I was literally crawling from my bed to the bathroom to pour myself the hottest bath to sink into for 20 minutes, you know, before I could even touch my toes. I just thought I was overtraining, but I didn't have my testosterone tested, but I'm sure that that's what it was. I was low testosterone. And so I don't believe that once somebody goes onto hormone therapy, then it's the advantage that all these people are trying to make it out to be, that you go through this, you know, testosterone wash and your puberty and all that. Granted, you can't take away the training that you've already done. Mm-hmm. Once you go onto hormone therapy, there's not a whole lot of advantage. So I think in time, people will see that, you know, and understand that. I just hope, because the IOC basically lied about the whole testosterone thing. So we thought that it was based in research, but we've learned that it's not based in research. It was just a, you know, jab in the dark at a number. And so they lied to us. Now we have to embrace that information and not hold so firmly to our previous belief.
Right. You've had such a tremendous career as an athlete and an advocate. What stands out to you as your biggest accomplishment?
Definitely my biggest accomplishment to date, definitely was my book, Breaking the Surface, because that was so impactful at a time when it was needed.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, that was really incredibly powerful.
Yeah, great book. I did read it. How do you want to be remembered?
If I'm remembered as a diver, I hope they think of me as being strong and graceful. And as a human being, that I made a difference.
Absolutely. What can we expect to see you in the near future? Your podcast, is that coming out soon?
Podcast. Hopefully it's coming out soon. So many stops.
Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me. All my social is at Greg Louganis, and gregluganis.com is my website.
And do you read your DMs? Do you answer people's responses? Like, do you care what people are writing to you?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I get on there and I, you know, peruse and it's like, yeah. I mean, and especially, oh my God, I just got an email from somebody thanking me for responding to a stranger in Houston about the medication, you know, the HIV medications and all that, one of the side effects and all that. And I answered them, it's random. You know, sometimes I get to it, sometimes I don't, but it was really, really sweet. So yes, I do. No, I don't read everything. You know, there's chances are depending on, you know, what's going on, how I connect with it and all, then I respond sometimes.
Good. All right. So people listening, you can write him on Instagram and you may get a response. So Greg, you have reinvented yourself time and time again. I think you're a true hero. You definitely have changed people's lives and I can't wait to see what you do next. I look forward to the podcast. I look forward to any movie that comes out, whatever it is, I will be watching. So thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review if you like what you hear. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or guests that you want us to reach out to? Please email us at infomisunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to see you next time.